A great way to understand the complex histories of Eastern Europe is hearing the stories its people tell about themselves in their legends and folklore.
I think it's so essential because it gets you under that surface. It gets you away from that story of kings and queens and into the story of regular people.
Find some of the least touristed parts of Europe in the countries of the Southern Balkans, Albania, North Macedonia, and Kosovo.
One of the most interesting architectural gems in the Balkans is situated there.
And for something completely different, go people watching among the fashionistas when they've got their credit cards out in Milan.
Sometimes they have somebody carrying the shopping bag from them because, you know, that's very chic. And somebody else carrying their dogs because that's also chic.
Come with us for the hour ahead as we go to busy modern Milan and to Europe's mostly unknown nations in the Balkans. And we'll uncover the roots of Eastern Europe in its folklore. It's all coming up on Travel with Rick Steves. It's Italy's commercial powerhouse city, and where you can see Da Vinci's masterpiece, The Last Supper. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, we'll hear why Milan is a favorite place for guides from small-town Italy to escape into high culture and fashion. Plus, our favorite tour guide from Bulgaria wants you to know about the neighboring countries he calls the Unknown Balkans. He has suggestions for visiting the Southern Balkans, with their rustic charm as backdoor destinations. If any of your ancestors came from the countries we usually think of as Eastern Europe, I'll bet you'd be surprised by the stories and legends they probably heard growing up. Jacob Mikanowski has researched his own Jewish and Catholic family roots in Poland and Lithuania and became fascinated with uncovering what the lives of the everyday people were like in this volatile region and how their stories and sense of humor convey a history that's long been crisscrossed by dueling empires and powerful rulers. He's written Goodbye Eastern Europe, an intimate history of a divided land, to stir up the narratives that nations often tell about themselves. Jacob, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, how do you define Eastern Europe?
So I kind of have a big tent definition, bigger than a lot of people who live in Eastern Europe, but it's between Germany on one side, Russia on the other, going from about Estonia in the north down to Albania in the south, that whole zone of small countries worried about their independence. And it's also a real cradle of European diversity.
And it's kind of a crossroads, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a series of intersecting frontiers, religious frontiers, imperial frontiers. There's a lot of fault lines running all the way through it.
I was just thinking tectonic plates when you said fault lines. It's really like that. And when you think this is where Slavic Europe hits Germanic Europe, this is where Orthodox Europe hits Islam. There's so many tectonic plates coming together, and geologically, you get earthquakes and volcanoes.
Absolutely. Big tensions. And that's been part of the history. That's why it's a divided land, and those divisions are multiple and overlapping.
Now, you wrote that the history you learned in Eastern Europe was written in the big imperial capitals, you know, Vienna, Istanbul, and St. Petersburg, and later in Berlin and Moscow. But now you see it a little bit differently. How do you see it?
So that is, if you read a lot of the history and you go back 200 years, go back 400 years, most of the region belonged to one of three empires, Ottoman, Austro-Hungarian or Habsburg, and Russian. And you read the history, it'll be written from those points of view. It'll be about the Habsburg emperors. It'll be about Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. You have that story told from those capitals, but it wasn't lived there. If you have Polish roots, you have Slovenian roots, you have Romanian roots, your ancestors lived a life far from the capital and lived in a different society, different world from that world of kings and queens. And kind of this tries to get back to that world of experience on the ground.
Yeah.
So not just the decisions of the big.
And by the way, the emperor probably spoke a language that you didn't understand. You know, you got the emperor in Vienna. He speaks German.
And you see them as a very distant, very remote figure. Your life.
And you're saying like the Ottomans and the Romanovs and the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns, the big royal families, 1918, they're all gone.
All gone.
Bam. Talk about fast history. And suddenly that big vast sweep from Estonia to Albania that you're talking about, it doesn't have that imperial overlord.
And it's a bunch of new nation states. Some of them have roots in the older past. Some of them are brand new. Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. Brand new. Some of them are combinations of weird stuff.
Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia, those have never been together. Yugoslavia, which is the land of the South Slavs, those have never been together, put together.
And in your book, you call it a land of small states and complicated fates.
It is that, you know, you don't get that with French history or Spanish history. Those boundaries are set 1,000 years ago and they kind of shift along the margins, but you don't have the sense of could France disappear one year, could Spain disappear. But these countries kind of come and go. They are independent for a while. They vanish. They come back. Ukrainian history is like that. Almost every story like that is of moments of sovereignty, long periods of being dominated.
And Jacob, when you think about the history, how we learn, who tells the history, most of the history was written from the imperial capital's perspective. But what I like about your book is it tells the history with folklore. Tell us about folklore as a teaching tool for understanding a story of a nation.
I think it's so essential because it gets you under that surface. It gets you away from that story of kings and queens and into the story of regular people. And folklore is really the literature of regular people, the literature of the poor, literature of the illiterate, which is what most people were for most of time. And to get that perspective, though, of the common person, the everyday person, folklore gives that to you. It gives you the mythological world of the different religions, different peoples that make this so rich.
What are the pros and cons of that?
The pros are you get a sense of the imaginative world of the past, of how things appeared, how things were understood. The con is it's not linear narrative history of events and time. It's much more the story of seasons and the story of generations and of little catastrophes and of stuff coming through. Yeah,
it's kind of organic.
And it can be a little intangible. Yeah. Because if you have that story from the capital, you have this king, this emperor, and then the next emperor and the reforms. But that story gets written like a soccer match, you know, like Hitler and Stalin will be kicking the soccer ball around between each other, or the emperor versus the sultan. But I'm kind of interested in the ball's perspective, you know?
Yeah.
In Eastern Europe, you feel a lot that history is being done to you.
Jacob Michanowski examines the culture, politics, religion, and ideologies of Eastern Europe over 2,000 years in his book, Goodbye, Eastern Europe, An Intimate History of a Divided Land. You'll find links to his work and his earlier visits with us with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So if we're thinking about folklore, I'm just trying to think of some examples, and your book is just filled with them. You've got a little chapter on vampires, and you talked about how in Western Europe, there's almost no countries that have a history of vampires. And in Eastern Europe, almost every country has a history of vampires. That's folklore. That's total, you know, that's just total la-la land. But it's part of that weave, the cultural weave.
And it goes deep. You know, that's the thing that there's another dimension. You know, paganism lasted longer in Eastern Europe than anywhere else in Europe.
Huh.
There were pagan princes in Lithuania when you already had the Renaissance going on in Italy.
Yeah.
This was the stronghold. And then it got pushed out, but went underground, went into kind of, you know, if you go to the Baltics, they have this real cult of the trees that there was an outdoor religion. And so trees were a huge part of that. And in Lithuania, they have famous oak trees. Like they'll put them on the postage stamps because it's like a famous oak. And they still have this cult of trees. And you can have been in Latvia, places where until recently, there are groves that you couldn't go into or you couldn't break any branch because they had that aura around them. And that's that remnants of paganism that's in there.
Yeah. It's like in Estonia, they've got these wonderful graveyards that are forests.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there, you're burying your loved ones and your ancestors with the trees and the spirit of the country. It's nationalism. It's gorgeous. It's really deep. It's powerful.
And that's why I try to get in folklore, because there's an element, there's the official history, and then there's something underneath that people feel very strongly.
What about, you know, Béla Bartók spent his whole career running around Hungary looking for folk tunes, the great composer Béla Bartók. He was dredging that country for its folk music. It must have been something to him.
And he said something really beautiful. He, you know, he would go to Hungary, and Hungary used to be bigger than Hungary. He used to cover a lot of Romania, used to cover most of Slovakia, used to cover a little bit of Serbia. And he said, actually, there is no national folk music. There's no Hungarian melody. There's no Romanian melody. There's no Roman melody. These melodies all just communicate and transform and get picked up from village to village, valley to valley. And you can't isolate any kind of ethnic side. That's folklore. It's that common language of melody and music and mythology and literature.
And speaking of singing, it reminds me of Estonia. Because Estonia, imagine trying to survive a little country of 1 million people who speak Estonian. And Russia's got its sights on you. Russia wants you off the map. And Germany's no friend either. And the Estonians realize we're hopelessly outgunned, but we can sing, so at least people know we're here. And the Estonians heroically sang, and it helped. You could say it actually helped bring down the Soviet Union.
It absolutely did. It had these Singing festival turned into an independence celebration, turned into an independence movement. That's the same idea that
and
the
what,
wealth, yeah.
What are they singing about?
The folklore,
the ghosts of Estonia in the forest where their loved ones' bodies are going back to dust.
And they wrote, they recreated a kind of pagan past from themselves because all that got fragmented and lost. And then in the 19th century, they came up with a version of it that they could celebrate. And that drew on that past, that drew on bits and pieces of local folklore and names and recreated it.
Jacob, to wrap up this conversation about getting beyond conventional history, what's a folk legend or something from your childhood growing up in a Polish family? What's an example for you of a folk legend that has some meaning?
The Black Wedding. It's a Schwarze Kasane. This is a Yiddish idea. And this actually happened in my grandfather's shtetl. He's from a little...
What's a shtetl?
Shtetl means little town. But these little towns used to dot Poland, Lithuania, Jewish majority towns. Most of the people in them, 50%, 70% would be Jewish. And sometimes they'd have a terrible disease or plague would come in. And if, you know, people would try medicine, they would try doctors, they would try. But they didn't have antibiotics, didn't have real things to call on. And when things are really bad, you had to go back to the thing that most Eastern Europeans go back to, which is the dead. The dead are everywhere, and the dead can harm or they can help. And when things got really bad, and this actually happened in my grandfather's shtetl in 1893, there was a bad outbreak of typhus, 20 people died in one night, and they said, well, we have to have a black wedding. And a black wedding is when you take two people who can't get married otherwise, who are crippled, who are too poor, and you take them, and the town acts as matchmaker, and you say, you and you, you're going to get married. And we're going to give you everything you need. The town gives them everything they need for the wedding. They give them everything they need, all the bridal stuff. And they have the wedding in the cemetery because it's such a happy event. And the dead in the cemetery get to be the guests, to take part in that happiness. And the hope is if they do that, they'll reward the town by getting the plague to go away. And I always thought that was just a pure legend, that this is completely kind of made up. And I was doing research for this book, and there was... in my grandfather's shtetl, and the account was actually written by my great-grandfather's uncle. It was something he had seen with his own eyes, a real factual thing. They really did the black wedding. The people involved became kind of known in town. The woman became the town's daughter-in-law, and she was, you know, this poor woman, but she was proud because she had helped stop the plague. You know, I was writing about this during COVID, and I'm like, well, different times, but same concerns, same preoccupations.
In 1893, as you said, not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
Jacob Mikanowski, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your teaching about Eastern Europe.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Jacob Mikanowski writes about solar storms, insect die-offs, and his great-grandfather's role in communist Poland. It's at jacobmikanowski.com, spelled M-I-K-A-Nowski. We'll get tips for enjoying Italy's capital of finance, fashion, and design in just a bit. But first, let's head south to the Balkans for three countries you probably never think about. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves.
Ich bin Don von Gimmelwald und ich reise mit Rick Steves. I just said in Swiss German, I'm Don from Gimmelwald and I travel with Rick Steves. Ich bin Don von Gimmelwald und ich reise mit Rick Steves.
Tucked away in the far corner of the Balkans, Albania, North Macedonia, and Kosovo might truly be the last unknown area of Europe. The region that's usually overlooked or avoided by most tourists is quietly opening up to tourism these days. I think these three little countries deserve another look, and not only for the lack of crowds and the easy-on-the-wallet appeal, but they have a tapestry of cultural influences, stunning scenery, and friendly people, and you're likely to be glad that you made time for a look at Kosovo, Albania, and North Macedonia. So, to guide us, we're joined by Stefan Bozajev from neighboring Sofia in Bulgaria. Stefan's led groups, and he knows these countries well, and he joins us right now. Stefan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rick, and I'm very happy that we have the chance to talk about these three little gems of Europe.
So we're going to these three countries, and I'll say the names again because they're quite rarely known by a lot of Americans. Albania, Kosovo, North Macedonia. Tell us Well, Albania has long been an independent country. Kosovo, North Macedonia, what is their political status today?
Well, Kosovo and North Macedonia, they're independent countries. However, 30 years ago, and a little bit more, they were part of former Yugoslavia. And actually, after the secession started, North Macedonia was one of the countries that peacefully seceded from Yugoslavia. And then Kosovo, it is a relatively new country which practically gained independence as a result of the last war in former Yugoslavia.
So, Stefan, to visit these countries, do you need a visa? Are there complicated border crossings, or do people just drive right across like most of Europe?
It is very easy to cross into these countries. No visa is needed for Americans, so it is so easy to go there.
Now, I remember when I rented a car a few years ago in Italy, I had to pay an extra insurance fee for the risk of car theft. And they said there was a lot of car theft relating to Albania. That indicates to me there's a lawlessness there. Why would I have to pay that extra fee on my car? And what is the situation just from a safety? What are the scams? What's the law and order situation in these countries?
Pretty much these countries these days are very safe to travel for independent travelers and organized travel alike. Practically, the lawlessness was back in the 90s, in the early 2000s.
So why do you think there's so little appreciation of these countries, at least, from the American market?
Well, first of all, these countries are little. They're in the dark region of Europe, as I always say, in the troublemakers, in the Balkans, and quite often they are not on the news. Quite often you cannot hear anything about these countries. Quite often you will visit the neighboring Croatia, and you visited Slovenia and Greece to the south, and that's easy to skip them. But actually there's so much to be seen and explored there.
I want to talk about each of these countries with you. Well, let's just go through them. We'll talk about Albania first, and then Kosovo, and then North Macedonia. What's Albania known for?
Well, Albania is definitely known for its mountains. It's situated on the Adriatic coast, just across Italy. And from those beautiful and serene beaches, it is right up in the mountains. It is the country of eagles. It's on their coat of arms. It's on their national flag. And they live up in the mountains.
So the eagles live up in the mountains.
This is at least what they say. Up in the mountains. These are our eagles here in the Balkans.
Now, Albania has had a mysterious kind of political history. I mean, they gained their independence about 110 years ago or so, 1912. They became a kingdom, then a communist dictatorship, and now a democratic republic. Talk about the politics of Albania that are unique. They had a very hardline dictatorship for a while.
Well, when the Iron Curtain spread across Europe back in the late 1940s, Albania became one of the most secretive communist countries in the world, probably equal to North Korea. They established a communist regime led by their ruthless leader, Enver Hoxha. They closed the borders, and actually, in the late 1960s, it turned out that they were not friends with China. They were not friends with the USSR. So practically, they were an island in the middle of the earth.
Now, this dictator, Enver Hoxha, H-O-X-H-A, he did some amazing things. He was quite, let's say, a character. What are some of the unusual things he did during his dictatorial reign?
Well, I will definitely come up first with the bunkers. Well, they had a program to build bunkers all around, different type of bunkers. Some of them were one person, others could fit a whole regiment there.
So these were concrete military bunkers, is that right?
That's right. And you could see them, and you can even still see many of them in the cities, in the rural areas, in the mountains, across the sea, because Enver Hoxha was a paranoid. He believed that he could be easily attacked by any of his neighbors. And that was the reason to have hundreds of thousands of bunkers.
Hundreds of thousands. So when you travel around Albania today, you'll see all of these little concrete souvenirs from their communist dictator back when they were as mysterious and isolated as we think of North Korea. Stefan Bozajev is our guide on Travel with Rick Steves. He's a certified tour guide who specializes in Bulgaria and its neighbors. At Stefan's suggestion, he's helping us better appreciate the nearby nations of North Macedonia, Albania, and Kosovo. These are countries we might call the unknown Balkans because they're still emerging on the tourist map, distinct from the more crowded resort destinations up and down the Aegean. Stefan is based in Sofia, Bulgaria, and guides with Ljuba Tours. That is spelled L-Y-U-B-A. Okay, so we are in Albania, Stefan. Describe Tirana, the capital city of Albania.
Well, Tirana is probably one of the most bustling cities in the Balkans, in our part of Europe. A lot of new buildings were finished. A lot of young people are all around. And you can still see a blend of different cultures, from the fascist architecture from the 1930s, built by Italian architects, through the monstrosities of the communist regime, now preserved as museums, into bunkers, till the present-day Albania, which is young and smiling and welcoming nation.
And is it really a democracy today? What's the political feeling in Albania?
Albania definitely is a democracy today. It's a democratic country. They are members of NATO, and now they're applying to become members of the European Union. And you know, if you want to be a member of those clubs, one of the main criteria is to be a democratic country. So they are.
That's right. Hey, Stefan, let's cross the border now and let's go to Kosovo. And I think Kosovo is interesting because it's what I thought of as Albania back when you could not go to Albania as a tourist. And of course, now you can go to Albania, but there's a lot of Albanian ethnicity in Kosovo. Can you explain who are the people that live in Kosovo, which is the small region just bordering Albania on the north, right?
Yeah, correct. Kosovo is bordering Albania to the north, northeast. And actually, when you cross the border, it will be the very same language. It will be Albanian, because the majority of the people of Kosovo, they're ethnic Albanians. However, there's a small, tiny group of Serbs, mostly in the northern counties of Kosovo, but predominantly more than 90% of the population are ethnic Albanians.
Now, Albania and Kosovo are two of the cheapest places in Europe to travel. And if you went to Kosovo, what are the cities that you would experience? What's the capital? What would be the most interesting town to put on your itinerary?
Definitely, if you go to Kosovo, you have to visit the capital because the international airport is there, the Pristina Airport. There, it's a relatively new city. You can see their Catholic cathedral dedicated to Mother Teresa, who was an ethnic Albanian. And in my view, one of the most interesting architectural gems in the Balkans is situated there. It's a Yugoslav period building of the National Library, 101 domes building with concrete, glass, and steel. It's a blend of all the architectural styles in these lands. So this will be in the capital. Also there you can see the newborn monument. It's a monument that celebrates the independence of Kosovo. Or just across the street, you can see the Heroinat monument. It's a monument dedicated to more than 20,000 women who, during the war, were kidnapped and raped and tortured. And the people pay respect to those brave girls and women who easily during conflict become the first victims of the conflict.
Sounds like it has some wonderful architecture and some powerful monuments to the difficult recent history with the wars that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia. I went to a beautiful town when I was in Kosovo, Prizren, P-R-I-Z-R-E-N. And that has a very long history with the people there. Tell us about what we might find in Prizren.
Yes, Prizren is probably the most scenically located city in all of Kosovo. It's around an hour drive from the capital to get there, and it's a beautiful blend between old Ottoman architecture and mosques, and at the same time, medieval Serbian churches and monasteries preserved in the heart of the city. And on top of it, the remains of medieval fortress. It's a bustling town where even there is international film festival. There are other festivals where people simply enjoy their heritage.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Stefan Bozajev, and we're talking about the three unknown countries in Europe, Albania, Kosovo, North Macedonia. And our third visit is North Macedonia. What's North Macedonia known for?
Definitely, when we talk about North Macedonia, this is the heart of the Balkans. It's a landlocked country, and it's a place often associated with Alexander the Great of the Macedon dynasty. It's a country associated with rich medieval heritage, but most remarkably, it's a country associated with some of the oldest lakes in the European continent, and these are Ohrid and Prespa lakes.
Ohrid, O-H-R-I-D. What a wonderful experience. I'll never forget going to Ohrid and a beautiful town on the lake by the same name, Ohrid. Describe the town of Ohrid.
The town of Ohrid is actually known as the town of light. It's known as the town of the 365 churches because the legend says that there used to be a church for every single day of the year. Today, it is protected by UNESCO, a beautiful old town with some Roman heritage. They have discovered remains of an amphitheater there. But most beautiful and elegant are the houses from the late 1700s and the 1800s. Whitewashed walls, red tiles on top of it, and just above the waters of Ohrid Lake.
Stefan, we're talking about North Macedonia. And I know there's been a long-standing dispute between the people of Greece and the people of former Yugoslavia and Serbians and so on about the use of the name Macedonia. What's the issue about the name Macedonia, and how is North Macedonia different from the rest of Macedonia?
Actually, to start with, Macedonia more or less is a geographical term. It's a region that today belongs to three different countries: North Macedonia, Greece, and Bulgaria. So in Greece, there's a region called Macedonia, and this is the reason why after Macedonia became an independent country in the early 1990s, the Greeks were not happy with that. They were not happy having a neighboring country with the very same name as one of their administrative regions, and till practically a few years ago, as a result of the so-called Prespa Agreement, signed on a little boat in the middle of the waters of Prespa Lake, where the two countries resolved the dispute, and this is how they come up with the name North Macedonia, describing the northern part of the whole region of Macedonia.
Okay, so in former Yugoslavia, all of what was Macedonia is now called North Macedonia, just in order to have a more peace with the Greeks, who have a region also called Macedonia, right?
Absolutely.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're discovering the rewards that the underappreciated Balkan countries of Albania, Kosovo, and North Macedonia offer the curious traveler. You know, they may not appear on the top of many travelers' wish lists, and I think that's just one reason why you want to consider visiting. Our guide right now is Stefan Bozajev. Stefan's been guiding in his home country of Bulgaria for decades. He has a passion for helping travelers understand and enjoy the underrated areas of the Balkans. You can find him on Facebook at Down the Road with Stefan, and that's Stefan with an F. Stefan, I'd like to just wrap up our conversation by talking about food in each of these regions. When you're going to travel to Kosovo, to Albania, to North Macedonia, what is the best food item you should be mindful of in each of these countries?
First of all, these countries, they might look so close, they're neighboring, but at the same time, the cuisine may be different. Actually, in Albania, it's on the sea, so they have a lot of seafood on the table. At the same time, when you are up in the mountains, you shouldn't miss their stews. nice sausages. And when we cross the border to Kosovo, the cuisine will be pretty much similar. Of course, a lot of fresh salads, tomatoes, cucumbers, different cheeses. And then the third country, in North Macedonia, well, one of the best dishes that I've had there is a bean stew called grafce tavce. You have these big beans baked into oven with some tomato sauce and onions, and it's simply delicious.
Ooh, nice. And if you want to wash it down with a local liqueur, a little fire water, what would you use? What would you drink?
All around these countries, you can find a liqueur that is very strong, and this is liqueur that is typically close to the Slivovitz. So it's like a plum brandy under the name of Raki, which you can find in all of those countries.
All right. Stefan Bozajev, thank you so much for introducing us to perhaps the most mysterious and least touristed parts of Europe, Albania, Kosovo, and North Macedonia. Hope to see you there, Stefan.
Hope to see you there, Eric. Thank you. Германия, Рома на Боливия, Италия, Нью-Йорк, бизнес, Америка, all around the world, my family. Волга, Русия, Транссибирия, 24 hours to Australia, here and there and everywhere, all around the world, my compañía. Here I come, here I go.
Stefan Bozajev tells us what souvenirs he'd take home from each of these unknown Balkan countries. You can hear that with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. He's also on Facebook at Down the Road with Stefan. Italy's financial center is one of the largest metro areas in Europe, but Milan is not one of the first places most people plan to explore when they visit Italy. Up next, guides from Italy recommend why you should include Milano on your next visit. It's Travel with Rick Steves. They say for every church in Rome, there's a bank in Milan. Visitors to Italy's high-powered center of commerce find that Milan is also rich with fashion and design, masterpieces of art and opera, and it's the industrious heart of today's Italy. For an appreciation of what Milan has to offer, we're joined by two tour guides based in Italy. Donald White lives about an hour away in the scenic Lake District near the Swiss border, and Alfredo Vitale is from Naples in the south. Gentlemen, benvenuti.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Alfredo, you're from Napoli.
Yes,
I am. That's sort of the opposite extreme of Milano. From your perspective in the south of Italy, looking up at the business capital in the north, what do Neapolitans think about Milano?
Well, it's been really a very controversial, you know, relationship going through the years. But for us Neapolitans, especially when I was young, when I was in my end of teenage years, I was actually looking, like many other friends, to Milan as the only city in Italy where you could have an European perspective. And especially if you were a creative person, you would look to Milan as the city. Like a reference city for you.
Many of my friends. It's the city of design. It's the city of Europe.
Yeah, actually, a couple of my friends went there to work into the fashion industry. Some people went there to the university, both for engineering and for MBA. We have the best MBA school in Milan called Bocconi.
And if something is going to fit in with the hardworking German style of economy and everything in Italy, it's going to be Milano.
Definitely. And also it's one of the most cosmopolitan cities we have in Italy.
All right. Thank you. And Don White, Donato, do your friends call you Donato?
No.
No. Donato Bianco.
Donato Bianco, no. And Don in Italy is dangerous. It makes you either a priest or a mafioso. So,
so you
just stick to Donald.
Donald, what's your story? You've settled in Lake Como, just the kind of the beautiful romantic lake just an hour north of Milano. You're not Italian.
No, but I moved to Italy first. I lived in Milan for 3 years, 1989 to 1992, and I was teaching there in Milan. Uh-huh. And then I moved out to Lake Como.
But you hop on that train and in 1 hour you're in the big city.
1 hour, yes.
So from your perspective, what characterizes Milano among Italian cities?
It's different from other cities. It's more down to earth. In some ways, it is very much work-oriented. They have a different mentality, and it is more Germanic. And although I never learned Milanese dialect, my friends taught me one phrase, which is Varpusse unanda kecentandem.
And what is that?
It means it's better for one person to actually get up and go than for 100 people to say, let's go, let's go.
That's a nice phrase to remind people when you're in Italy. Because when I cross the border in Italy, the first thing I think is il dolce far niente.
Exactly.
And what does that mean?
That means the sweetness of doing nothing. And that's also possible in Milan.
Yeah.
But once you've done your work, once you get to aperitivo time.
Because when you're in Milan, it feels like people have this brisk step. There's power lunches.
Everything. It is a business city.
It's a business city. In fact, they say, as I mentioned in the introduction, there's a bank in Milan for every church in Rome. That sums it up quite nicely.
Yeah.
There's a rivalry between Rome and Milano. What's with that?
Well, they say also, I remember they told me when I was working there, Milan works so that Rome eats.
Milan works so Rome eats. Mm. Well, Alfredo, you're down in Napoli, where, yes. I mean, everything is just let's live for today in Napoli more than in Milano. What do you think? Do you think they're out of balance or do they think you're out of balance?
You know, there is a very good exchange because actually they love coming to Napoli on vacation, the Milanese people. We have many of them coming down and they love actually coming to Napoli because they just love that atmosphere that normally they don't have in their cities.
Right.
And it's the same for us. I mean, I will not say I go to Milan because it's the most beautiful city in Italy. We have so many beautiful cities.
The climate is not the best.
Exactly. The climate is not the best.
Oh, my goodness. It's such a beautiful climate, but you're spoiled. So you want better climate yet. You'd go farther south?
No, it's just particular to Milan because it sits in a fog pit.
It's a fog pit with millions of people.
That's why they all leave on the weekend to go to the mountains, to go to the sea and get out of the fog.
So, Alfredo, when you go to Milano, what would be on your list of things to do?
Well, there are a few things because it's not a beautiful city, but there are some beautiful areas. There is some beautiful, you know, little places. Like if you go for a walk in Via Mozart, which is an amazing legal street, really central, with beautiful houses and gardens where you can see amazing
pedestrian streets.
Pedestrian street, Brera area is so nice.
Well,
what's
the big one that goes up to Forteza, Via Cavour.
Via Cavour.
Via Cavour. It used to be a traffic jam, and now it's a park.
I know. They're improving a lot on that point of view. When you are in Brera, you are in a very, you know, artisty and beautiful area for cafes, and it used to be the area of the famous bars for the aperitivo, like the Jamaica, which used to be a very famous one.
And then you can go out to the canal district also. That's quite trendy.
Yeah, actually, that's another beautiful area, the area of the Navigli, with some very good restaurants. My favorite restaurant in Milan is in that area.
In the Navigli.
Which one?
And it's called Pont de Fer, Bridge of Iron, the Iron Bridge.
The Iron Bridge.
And Pont it's very good, very, very good.
This is
like Berlin.
Berlin.
Berlin. No, Berlin.
Berlin. Berlin. That's a restaurant.
Yes,
And how do you say this district, the canal district?
Navigli.
Navigli. A reminder that Milan, while it's buried way in the middle of the country, has canals, and it used to have a small port anyways.
They used to say that they had more canals in Milan than in Venice before Mussolini covered them all over. And that the water is still there. And that's why it's so humid in the summer, because the water underneath the street is still there, and we have so many mosquitoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know,
amazing number of mosquitoes.
When you look at the Duomo, the magnificent cathedral, this flamboyant, so many spires, so many statues, the sort of final over-the-top flowering of the Gothic movement before the more stately Renaissance domes. You wonder, how did they get all that marble there? And they actually had a canal.
It came from Lago Maggiore when it was brought down.
A quarry nearby. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Don White and Alfredo Vitale. We're talking about Milano. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Lynn's calling from Kew Gardens in New York. Lynn, have you been to Milano?
I've been to Milano so many times, I can't count because I go for work. And I've been very, very lucky to go there. But my favorite thing is the aperitivo time. And you can go super sophisticated to the Bulgari Hotel or the Dolce Gabbana Cafe and have these lovely, lovely appetizers with a drink. But the best part there is seeing the crowd come in after 7. So go a little bit before 7, get your seat, and just watch the Milanese come in their beautiful outfits. It's amazing. And then, since you mentioned the Duomo, you can go to the Rinascente department store on the top floor and overlook the Duomo at the very top. You can almost touch all the sculptures, and it's marvelous for that kind of viewing.
There's a whole series of department stores with open-air terrace kind of restaurants up at the roof level of the cathedral, isn't there?
Oh, yes, there are a few. Over at, right across on the other side of the Duomo, there is another one that's very good.
Well, it's just,
I can't remember the name of that one.
But it's so user-friendly and just it's a celebration of the architecture and the history and the food of Milano. Tell me, Lynn, a little more about the aperitivo, because I understand it's you buy a drink and you get a little buffet of delightful little things to eat. What might you eat?
Well, at Dolce & Gabbana in Bulgari, they give you the more sophisticated fare. There is mozzarella bars and carrot sticks or whatever. They've changed it throughout the years and it's got a little bit more sparse. Mm. Barbasso, which is a very traditional place that the Milanese really go to also.
I used to live just above Barbasso.
You did?
Yeah.
So, Don, when you think about the aperitivo, Don,
In terms of apericena, where it becomes dinner.
Uh-huh.
And that's why a lot of people after work go there because they've had a hard day. They probably have a big lunch and then they just have their apericena on the way home.
So the tradition is aperitivo, but the nickname for going there and scamming a free dinner out of the cost
aperitivo.
Of a cocktail is that
yes.
is a cena is the word for dinner. So
yes.
aperitena.
Yes, exactly.
And really you can buy a drink or a cocktail for less than $10 and dinner
yeah.
you know, comes
yeah,
with it.
Comes
I mean,
it,
if you
yeah.
want a light
yeah.
dinner, if you like the...
Yeah, and in Italy, actually, Milan was really the city to start
it was
this
the first.
Aperitivo
yeah.
tradition. This is why we refer to Milan also. Actually, there was a saying, I'm not sure it was very positive to call Milan la città da bere, Milano da bere.
What is bere?
To drink. The city to drink.
Hey, Lynn, thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Thank
okay,
you.
Take care.
Il treno regionale veloce delle ore 11:13 per Torino Porta Nuova è in partenza dal binario 7.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Milan, and our guides are Don White and Alfredo Vitali. You know, a lot of people go to Milan to see Leonardo's Last Supper, magnificent piece of art. Don, what is the trick for seeing the Last Supper smartly?
You have to get a reservation.
It's required.
It is. Or you have to spend a lot of money just buying it from a tour company. It's going to charge you extra, but we'll get you in.
So just go online and book your time.
But if you know when you're going to be there,
right.
get your reservation. It's smart.
And then it's so orderly and civilized.
It is.
There's no crowds there because, you know, 25 people show up every 15
well,
minutes.
Well, you see,
that's
Rick,
it.
I go back to the days when you could just wander in any time when I lived there. It was like that, and it's not like that now. But not only from the crowding point of view, but because they want to protect. It's a very delicate painting.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to come into this kind of detoxification
exactly.
chamber before right. you get
so you,
to...
So you that dry they never, out a little bit.
Well, no. So yeah, exactly, because there's too much humidity coming
yeah.
in. And even in Leonardo's time, the paint was coming off the wall and then... So it's a painting which suffered a lot,
mm-hmm.
and so you can respect why they have to control this.
And apart from Leonardo's Last Supper, Alfredo, there's other important sites to see. What are two or three other sites we'd want to be sure to check out when we go to Milan?
Well, definitely you want to see the Duomo. I mean, it's such an amazing cathedral and unique
and you can go to the rooftop
style.
Too.
You can visit inside, go to the rooftop. And as we were mentioning before, also there is a way to go to the opposite side, which is the Rinascente department store, and go to the top floor. And from there, you have even a better view
yeah.
on the roof.
Without because you can just go up there free on the elevator and walk
yeah,
out. And
yeah, yeah, and then there is cafes
the
if you want. You yeah. can get a drink also at the same time. It's very,
very
nice.
Important. The cathedral was filled with great art, and now most of that art is actually in the museum just across the way, and they've reopened that museum, and it's magnificent.
Yeah, Museo del Duomo, and there is also actually in terms of museums, not only that one, but actually Milan is very, very interesting. For example, Brera. In Brera, you see many beautiful
B-R-E-R-A. Brera.
Yeah, Brera, which is not only a museum, but it's a neighborhood, which is very interesting
yeah.
because it is the artist's neighborhood
and
of
you'll
Milan.
See the greatest masters in Europe. If you can think of the most famous painters, they probably have a painting or two in the Brera.
Oh, actually, in Brera, they have Titian, they have Raphael, they have Da Vinci also.
Uh-huh.
They have the portrait of a musician there.
Isn't it it's associated with a school or an art school? Or is that
oh, yeah, Brera is the art school.
It's
the
art
main
school.
Art school of Lombardia. It's one of the main art schools in Italy, and so the artists. This is why it's an artist neighborhood.
And then, of course, right off of the square from the Duomo, you've got the Gallery Victor Emmanuel. And
yeah.
this is just the first modern shopping mall from, 120 years ago?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's absolutely worth walking into. It's worth stopping off for your aperitivo there because Campari was invented.
Right there
in
the bar.
Well, the Campari family had the bar just as
yeah.
you go in on the left. And so It's a classic place for a drink, and also a classic place once you've been to the opera, you're going to come out and you're going to go to Savini for dinner.
Yeah. So we're talking about these elegant people. Yes, they're going to tumble out of that opera house all dressed up and have their Campari.
Yeah, La Scala is just across from there. I mean, you know, when you exit the Galleria from the opposite side, where then Duomo Square, you get just in front of La Scala. Is right there, which is so amazing. I love going there. I'm from Napoli.
I wish people could see your face right now, the way you brighten up and smile.
I'm from Napoli, and I have one of the most beautiful theaters in my city, which is San Carlo, which is considered the most beautiful in Europe, actually. Right. But the productions that they have at La Scala are so beautiful, interesting, powerful, that every year at least once I take the time to go there.
So much to see. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking Milano with Don White and Alfredo Vitali. We're talking about the historic and the artistic wonders. There's also a new neighborhood. Don, talk about the new port.
Well, this was the Porta Nuova.
Yeah.
It's an area which is skyscrapers, if you like, but very, very distinctive skyscrapers. We've got the vertical forest up beyond the Porta Nuova.
The vertical forest, meaning like a high-rise condominium building with just bushy with trees.
With so many trees, it's very good.
Yeah, Tito Boeri building. Yes. Tito Boeri is a famous architect.
Imagine if all of our skyscrapers were bushy with trees.
I saw it the first time from the train, and I was just amazed, like, how did they grow these trees all overnight?
But this is one of those sites. I thought I knew Milan. You know, I update it for my guidebook. Every couple of years I go there. And then all of a sudden, Porta Nuova. It's the new port. And it's just this forest of skyscrapers, very futuristic, very people-friendly, and a good example about how
there is another,
cities are a work in progress.
There is another new thing in Milan which people should visit, and this is Fondazione Prada.
The Prado?
Prada. You know the fashion.
The foundation of Prada. Yeah. Okay, and what is that?
And it's an art, contemporary art museum, which is not far from Porta Romana. And it's actually a very new area with beautiful, beautiful contemporary art.
Nice.
And also happening, some of the fashion week takes place there. There is this interconnection in Milan, you know, in
so
between
much.
Worlds.
Yeah. So much. Yeah. You stand on the main square of the Duomo, and on top of the Duomo you see this golden statue, beloved by the Milanese.
La Madonnina.
Oh, La Madonnina.
How can you not
the Virgin
see
Mary.
Yeah.
The little Madonna.
Exacto.
It's
Madonnina.
Little. She's probably big, but on top of that big church she looks little.
Little, but it's not.
But I'm in the mood for a drink and actually a little shopping. I'm not always in the mood for shopping, but in Milano I like to go shopping. Done. Take a shopping and let's get a drink on the way to Monte Napoleone.
Monte Napoleone is the heart of the fashion business. There's a wonderful cafe, very old-fashioned, it's very atmospheric, called Cova.
Uh-huh.
So I would start off there maybe for a cappuccino or to go for a drink, a prosecco, and then a little aperitivo. And then probably I'm going window shopping because that depends on your budget, but it's going to be a little bit expensive. But you definitely want to walk down Monte Napoleone, the Via Sant'Andrea, and Via della Spiga. And these are the three streets which make up the main fashion business.
What shops might we see there?
Oh, everybody.
Every famous name.
I mean, Armani, Prada, Versace.
Name it, they are there.
And Alfredo, you'll be walking, shopping. Take me walking for a block. And not only do you see the windows, but you see the people.
Oh, yeah, that's actually the best way to get Milan atmosphere, especially during the fashion week there, but not only. Even during a normal, weekend, you can see amazing Milanese ladies, you know, walking around and shopping their shopping bag. Sometimes they have somebody carrying the shopping bag from them. Because, you know, that's very chic. And somebody else carrying their dogs, because that's also chic.
Carrying their dogs. And even cigarettes are chic.
They have a word for the ladies, the rich ladies that do that kind of shopping in Milano. They're called the Shura.
What is that?
The Shura. It's a Milanese word for signora. But when you say Shura, you mean an upper class lady. The
so
ones
if you see
that
a
go
lady
shopping,
really well dressed with somebody carrying her dog.
Exactly. That's a Shura.
For sure. Don White, Alfredo Vitali, mille grazie for a better understanding of beautiful Milano. Everybody goes to Rome, Venice, and Florence.
Yeah,
don't forget Milano.
Go to Milan.
Milan is where it's at.
All right.
Grazie.
Thank you, Rick. Grazie. Ciao. Alla presto. Ciao.
We can travel in our imaginations with the original haiku poems our listeners send us from time to time at ricksteves.com/radio. Here's a few we thought you might like.
Stacy Bukowskis from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, sent us a few haiku snapshots from her travels, which often seem to include an inviting beach. Adventure beckons. Umbrella rainbow. Sparkling waves. Warm sand. Cold beer. Sandra Van Dam Anderson of Tucson wrote this haiku about Fanning Island in the middle of the Pacific in Kiribati. Heavenly footprint. Coral reef. Turquoise lagoon. Baskets. Shark teeth. Shells. And this one about Bora Bora. Sapphire. Indigo. Lapis. Turquoise. Cobalt blue. Water is heaven.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves guidebooks, over 50 of them, are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. That's because we lovingly update them in person so you can enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar in your next trip. Find them at your favorite bookseller and at ricksteves.com.